Go forward and to the right a little. There you go. At last the two ships met. A buzzer sounded as a set of docking latches on the two craft snapped shut. A relieved McDivitt said, I haven't heard a song like that in a long time. Apollo 9 had fulfilled all its major objectives. At that moment, Aldrin knew that Apollo 10 would also succeed and that he and Armstrong would attempt to land on the moon. On March 24th, NASA made it official. For Aldrin and his crewmates, training now went into high gear. Friday, April 18th, 1969, Building 9, Manned Spacecraft Center, Houston. Inside the cavernous expanse of Building 9, a lone figure clad in a bulky white spacesuit and backpack stood at the center of a small crowd of technicians. He stooped slightly under the burden of the equipment necessary to keep him alive in the vacuum of space. After the technicians had attended to the necessary adjustments, he strode stiffly to a silvery mock-up of a lunar module and stood in one of its bowl-shaped footpads, ready to begin the strange spectacle of a practice moonwalk. All set, Neil, if you read me.
Yeah, I read you, said Armstrong, answering the technician who was acting as Capcom.
Okay, proceed. Armstrong held on to the ladder that was attached to the mock-up's front landing leg and lifted his left foot over the footpad and onto a bed of sand. As he had practiced many times over the past few weeks, he tested his weight on the sand as if it were the moon and described what he saw.
Okay, checking the bearing strength, and we're leaving a 1/4-inch footprint, and we have a poorly sorted sand and gravel aggregate which does not stick to the boot. Range of the ground mass is from 1 centimeter down to below the resolution of the eye.
Now he stepped off the footpad and took a few steps.
My balance seems to be very much like Earth simulations. It was an optimistic thing for Armstrong to say, weighed down by 200 pounds of gear, but he had reason to expect that the real thing would be easier. In the past 2 months he had glimpsed what it might be like to walk in the moon's 1/6 gravity inside the KC-135, a converted Air Force cargo plane with a long padded cabin. By flying a carefully planned parabolic trajectory, the pilot of the KC-135 could create about 0.5 minutes worth of simulated lunar gravity, giving Armstrong time to practice scooping up rocks, or handling gear, or simply get accustomed to the surreal lightness that came with every step. With a few dozen parabolas per flight, a session on the KC-135 was enough to let Armstrong taste the freedom that the moon would offer him once he was there. But the bulk of his work was here, in Building 9, where a moonwalk was as hard as a day on a construction site. Like a polar bear lumbering about in his pen, Armstrong went about his work while a small crowd of technicians and training specialists looked on. As he moved, he struggled not only against the suit's weight, but its stiffness. Pressurized at 3.5 pounds per square inch, the suit was a rigid balloon in which every movement required effort. The gloves were clumsy, and it was especially difficult for Armstrong to manipulate a camera or grasp a geologic hammer. Simply opening or closing his hand was like squeezing a tennis ball. As he reached into a pocket on his spacesuit thigh and pulled out a collapsible long-handled scoop, technicians with headphones could hear his controlled but labored breathing. "We're beginning the contingency sample," Armstrong said. "I have the collector."
Standing at the sidelines, a fully suited Buzz Aldrin watched his commander at work and waited for the proper moment to join him. It had been decided in the summer of 1968 that the first landing mission would feature a single moonwalk. By February 1969, its duration had been decided at about 2 hours and 40 minutes. For months now, the people in the Space Center's Crew Systems Division had been working with him and Armstrong to make every minute on the lunar surface as productive as possible. The two men would collect rock and dust samples, lay out a few simple scientific instruments, and take pictures. All of it had to be rehearsed to the letter until the tasks became second nature. Never in the history of exploration had 2 hours and 40 minutes been so carefully planned.
Okay, Armstrong said. We're ready for the second man to come down now. Aldrin lumbered onto the sandy training area and began his work. Some of the NASA doctors, Aldrin knew, were predicting that he and Armstrong would have trouble adjusting to lunar gravity, that they would wear themselves out working in pressurized suits. Aldrin was sure they were wrong. With nearly 5.5 hours of spacewalking under his belt, he'd proved that an astronaut could do useful work outside a spacecraft in the three-dimensional ice rink called zero-G. Aldrin was certain that walking on the moon, with the luxury of a gravity field, would be even easier. It was the part that would come afterward that worried him. Media attention had always been the single biggest adjustment for the astronauts. Most of the original seven had been woefully unprepared for the barrage of attention that greeted them the day they were introduced to the press. The spotlight had dimmed somewhat since then, but not much, and most of the astronauts had learned to deal with the constant demands of their celebrity. There were even some, like Gene Cernan, who seemed to enjoy talking to the press about their experiences, but it wasn't so easy for Aldrin. Publicity was a double-edged sword. Whatever enjoyment he got from the recognition, it was far outweighed by his discomfort. He hated the question that awaited him on his return from Gemini 12. What did it feel like in space? He could go on at length about the technical aspects of the experience, his mobility during the spacewalk, or the computations he made during the rendezvous, but don't ask him to plumb his own feelings. It was the worst kind of bind. Sitting under the TV lights, he couldn't just shrug off the question with a pat response. He was too much the perfectionist for that, and so he was caught, struggling to find an honest answer when the only one he could think of was, I don't know. Aldrin's unease was so great that, given a choice, he would have preferred to be on the second lunar landing, or the third, instead of the first. For one thing, he would be able to put his scientific talents to greater use on a later mission, when the emphasis would be more on exploration. Even more important, there would be less attention. No one, save Aldrin's wife, knew that when he learned he would be on the lunar landing crew, he had briefly considered bowing out. He had rejected the idea just as quickly. No astronaut had ever resigned from a mission. If he asked to leave this landing crew, he might never get onto another one. Years later, Aldrin would say his mixed feelings were thrown into sharper focus by one issue in particular. In fact, it was the first question asked at the first press conference after the crew announcement. Which of you gentlemen will be the first man to step onto the lunar surface? Deke Slayton had been sitting up on the stage with Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins, and he told the press that the question hadn't been decided. Armstrong added, "It's not based on individual desire," and said it would be worked out as the training progressed, according to how best to accomplish the mission objectives. Of course, they all knew very well that there were very few astronauts who didn't want to be the first to walk on the moon. At one time, there had been a preliminary version of the checklist for the moonwalk, and on it the words LMP egress came before CDR egress. In other words, the lunar module pilot would go outside ahead of his commander. Aldrin could see sound reasons for having it that way. Armstrong had his hands full with the landing and with the mission commander's responsibility for the flight's overall success. Instead of adding more to that workload, didn't it make sense for Aldrin to take the lead when it came to the moonwalk? It had been the same way in Gemini. The co-pilot always made the spacewalk while the commander stayed inside and flew the spacecraft. And there was the matter of physical conditioning. The moonwalk was going to be physically demanding, and Armstrong was anything but an exercise fanatic. More than one astronaut remembers that Aldrin paid a visit, checklist in hand, explaining the operational merits of having the lunar module pilot get out first. There was nothing extraordinary about an astronaut campaigning for a pet cause, but this was no ordinary issue, and the Apollo crew commanders who heard about Aldrin's idea had strong reactions. For them it was simple. The commander gets out first. Of Aldrin they wondered, "Who is he kidding?" The Gemini precedent didn't apply, because a lunar module sitting on the moon wouldn't be in flight, it would be in port. And as any naval officer knows, the protocol on such matters is clear. When the ship comes to port, the skipper is always first down the gangplank. But in the end, there was something more decisive, outside the whims of human emotions. It was the lunar module's front hatch. The lunar module cabin had about as much space as a large broom closet. For one astronaut to go outside, the other man would have to hold the hatch open and stand back in his corner. The departing astronaut would then get down on his stomach and wriggle through an opening only 32 inches square. Getting out of the LM wasn't like going down a gangplank. It was more like being born. Years earlier, with the first landing still a long way off, Grumman engineers had designed the hatch so that it opened from left to right, that is, toward the lunar module pilot side of the cabin. The only way Aldrin could get out ahead of Armstrong would be if the men first changed places. That would have been possible for two men in street clothes, but not encased in pressurized suits and massive backpacks. One day Armstrong and Aldrin tried it, fully suited, in a lunar module mock-up, and they damaged the cabin. Deke Slayton was there, he saw the damage, and he told himself the situation would have to change. Mission planners had quietly come to the same conclusion in February, but well into the spring, Armstrong and Aldrin had not learned of any decision. But Aldrin heard rumors that Armstrong would be named to go out first, because he was a civilian and because NASA wanted to keep the first steps on another world free of any militarism. The implied slight against the Air Force, and the thought that the matter would be decided on political grounds instead of on operational considerations, angered Aldrin. But he knew there wasn't any point in maneuvering. It was best to be direct about it. He would take the issue to Armstrong. Their time on the Apollo 8 backup crew had left them with a sort of friendship. Not exactly drinking buddies, but hardly strangers. Still, as he entered Armstrong's office, he wasn't sure how his commander would take what he was about to say. "Neil, we've got to come to some kind of decision on this," Aldrin said, somewhat self-consciously. "I'm sure you know how I may feel about it." The words were out. There was an awkward silence. Armstrong looked uncomfortable. Was he embarrassed at Aldrin's directness? At last he spoke. "I'm aware of the historical significance of the decision, Buzz, and I'm not about to rule myself out." Years later, however, Armstrong would have no memory of their conversation. He had been aware that Aldrin had a certain focus on the issue, he would recall, and he felt sorry because he didn't care one way or the other. In fact, as Aldrin himself had suspected, Armstrong had nothing to do with the decision, and he was never asked for his opinion until after it was made. Slayton came by to say the plan was for him to go out first, and did he agree? In Armstrong's mind, the new plan was not only more practical, but far safer. He told Slayton, "Yes, that's the way to do it." In Slayton's mind, the decision was clear, hatch or no hatch. He recommended, and the managers agreed, that Armstrong, as Apollo 11's commander and as a senior astronaut, should be the first man to set foot on the moon, assuming, of course, that he and Aldrin were able to get there. By mid-May, that rested with the success or failure of Apollo 10, which was about to leave the Earth. 2. We is down among 'em. Monday, May 19th, 1969, 1:49 p.m. Houston time, aboard Apollo 10, 128,000 miles from Earth. If people want to know what kind of men go to the moon, there's a good look at one right there. Having prepared his Earthbound audience, Gene Cernan pointed the television camera at his commander, and a gum-chewing Tom Stafford, his balding head hidden under his communications hat, smiled back. Cernan said, "Could you believe it?" "Some people still don't," drawled Stafford. On Earth, where Stafford's grinning countenance filled television screens across the world, Capcom Bruce McCandless played straight man. "I'm surprised you all have not set this to music." Cernan answered, "Oh, you want music? Well, we'll give you some music." On the monitors, the image blurred and shifted, then came clear again, and there was the Earth. This time, thanks to Apollo 10's new TV camera, it was in full color. "Here it comes," Cernan said, as one of his crewmates activated a small portable tape recorder. "This is just so that you guys don't get too excited about the TV and forget what your job is down there." And then the sounds of Frank Sinatra and the Nelson Riddle Orchestra came, floating down from halfway across the translunar gulf. Fly me to the moon, let me swing among the stars, let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. The second voyage to the moon was underway, complete with background music. There was a time in the first part of 1968 when Tom Stafford thought he might have a chance of making the first landing, and more recently there had been others at NASA, most notably George Mueller, head of the agency's Office of Manned Spaceflight, who had pushed for a landing on Apollo 10. From the beginning, Mueller tried to quicken the pace of the moon program. It had been Mueller who insisted on all-up testing for the Saturn V. That is, launching a completely assembled booster instead of testing one stage at a time, as the more conservative engineers had wanted. Mueller's impatience had probably saved months in the race with the end of the decade. On the eve of Apollo 9's spectacular success, Mueller, like others at NASA, was asking, why in the world send the entire Apollo spacecraft to the moon with all the risks involved and not try to land? One reason was that Stafford's lunar module, built before Grumman enacted a super weight-saving program, was too heavy to land. There was some talk of letting Stafford use Armstrong's LM, the first one built that was light enough for a landing, and postponing Apollo 10 a month to allow the switch, but some, particularly Chris Kraft, raised strong objections. There were too many unknowns, he said. His trajectory people didn't understand the moon's lumpy gravitational field well enough yet to predict what mascons would do to the paths of the orbiting command and lunar modules. Would they pull the lander off course for its descent to the surface? And while the astronauts explored the moon, would mascons pull the command module off course for the rendezvous ahead? NASA needed more navigation data from Apollo 10 before it could commit the next crew to a landing. Furthermore, Kraft's flight controllers needed experience in communicating with two separate spacecraft at lunar distance. Sam Phillips, the tough, exacting Air Force general who served as Apollo program director, listened to all sides of the argument and decided that the dress rehearsal was not only desirable, but crucial. Tom Stafford agreed. He'd wanted the first landing as much as anyone else, but he wasn't about to campaign for a mission he knew was beyond accomplishing. Now was the time to find the hidden unknowns and solve them, so that Apollo 11 would be able to concentrate on the landing itself. And Apollo 10 wasn't simply a repeat of Apollo 9 in a different place. New procedures were required for a rendezvous in lunar orbit. Stafford and Cernan would take their lander and descend to 50,000 feet above the lunar surface, where they would make a critical test of the landing radar. Then, from this close vantage, they would scout Apollo 11's proposed landing site in the Sea of Tranquility before rejoining Young in the command module. By any measure, the dress rehearsal was a grueling mission. It seemed to Stafford's crew that they had more to do on Apollo 10 than all the others combined. With five Gemini flights among them, Stafford and his crew were the most experienced team yet sent into space. They had a camaraderie that came not only from having trained together for more than 2 years, but from a long personal history with one another. Stafford, a veteran of the first space rendezvous in 1965, went on to command Gemini 9 with Cernan as his co-pilot. He had come to know Cernan as a quick study with a sharp mind. Cernan also liked to party, and he liked the attention that came with being an astronaut. Once or twice, Stafford had to pry him away from some reporter and back to work. It was Cernan, as lunar module pilot, who had the major responsibility for the lander's systems. Stafford and John Young went a bit further back. They had been shipmates aboard the battleship Missouri 20 years earlier. Besides being a good pilot and a hell of an engineer, Young had a wonderful dry wit, a real down-home, country-boy type of delivery, and he was an expert on the command module systems. Stafford felt lucky to have him on the crew. Now, a day into their journey to the moon, Stafford, Young, and Cernan were following the trail blazed by Apollo 8. None of them believed for a moment that the second lunar voyage might somehow be routine, and their suspicion was confirmed as soon as their Saturn V thundered off from Pad 39B. Having heard the reports from Borman's and McDivitt's crews, Stafford and his crewmates thought they knew what to expect, but the ride was even more violent than they'd imagined, and the launch was only a prelude to the real heartstopper. 3 minutes into the translunar injection burn, the cabin began to vibrate with a strange buzzing sensation that the men both heard and felt. Something was wrong with the booster. "Okay," Stafford radioed to Houston, "we're getting a little bit of high-frequency vibrations in the cabin. Nothing to worry about." Those words were for the benefit of mission control. In reality, Stafford was sure the mission was over, and so were his crewmates. Cernan, in the right-hand seat, was already thinking ahead to the abort maneuver they'd have to perform to get back to Earth. The vibrations worsened until Stafford could barely read the instruments. His heartbeat quickened as he tried to puzzle out what might be happening. The only thing he could think of was a form of aerodynamic shaking that pilots call flutter. If it's bad enough, flutter can rattle an airplane to pieces. But how could flutter occur in a vacuum? Stafford held the abort handle in his left hand. With a twist, he could shut down the booster and end the mission. But he told himself, "No way. We've come this far. If she blows, then she blows." The three men held their breath as the nearly 6-minute burn continued. Stafford anxiously eyed the computer's velocity readout, which was climbing toward the 35,000-plus feet per second needed to send Apollo 10 to the moon. He said silently, "Come on, baby." At last, the booster shut down. On time, and Apollo 10 was right on course. Later, engineers would blame the vibrations, which were well within the spacecraft's design tolerance, on some of the booster's pressure relief valves, and would remedy the situation for future missions. Apollo 10's first heart stopper turned out to be a false alarm, but Stafford and his crew understood. They could take nothing for granted. Wednesday, May 21st, 9:49 p.m., Houston time. 3 days, 11 hours mission elapsed time. It had ridden into space nestled within the third stage of the Saturn V, hidden from view by a set of protective panels, waiting to be extracted from its berth. That had happened shortly after translunar injection, when John Young separated the command module, Charlie Brown, from the booster and pulled away. At the same time, the protective panels departed from third stage, exposing the lunar module, Snoopy, its metallic skin gleaming in the sunlight. Young then activated a special docking probe in Charlie Brown's nose and slowly steered the 32-ton command ship back toward the lander. The two ships met in a scene Freud would have loved, as Young guided Charlie Brown's docking probe into a conical port called the Drogue in Snoopy's roof. Tiny capture latches on the tip of the probe fit inside a hole at the Drogue center. Young retracted the probe, drawing the two ships together until 12 spring-loaded docking latches snapped shut, firmly mating the two craft. During the 3-day voyage, Snoopy had waited, dormant, docked to Charlie Brown's nose. Now, on Wednesday evening, Young opened the command module's forward hatch and removed the docking mechanism, opening up a short tunnel between the two craft and clearing the way for Gene Cernan to enter the lander. When he did, pushing off the command module's floor and floating through the tunnel, it was like entering another world. Opening Snoopy's hatch, he found himself staring at the floor of the tiny cabin as if he were hanging by his toes. He tucked his body into a spin until he was upright in the small gray space. The lander was a strange machine, even from the inside, but Cernan had come to know it well. In front of him was a square instrument panel, packed with switches, gauges, and displays. At waist height were two sets of hand controllers, one for each man. There were two small triangular windows, one on either side of the main panel, and a smaller rectangular rendezvous window in the ceiling on the commander's side. More panels, covered with circuit breakers, lined the side walls. Bundles of wiring and all kinds of plumbing were visible along the floor, exposed because covering them would have added too much weight. They gave the cabin the look of a boiler room. Behind him, atop a small ledge, the can-shaped cover for the lander's ascent engine protruded into the cabin. There were no seats. None were needed. The lunar module was the first true spacecraft. It flew only in the void of space. On the outside, the lunar module was as alien as the world it would land on. With no need for aerodynamic sleekness, it was an unlikely amalgam of angular shapes and boxes, rocket engines and antennae, doors and landing gear. No spacecraft before it had so completely merged form and function, and the result was a definite shift in appearance toward the organic. In the clean room at the Cape, where Cernan and Stafford had last seen it, the lander was a metal chrysalis, landing gear folded against its sides in preparation for the launch shroud. Now, in space, it was a huge robotic insect with two triangular windows for eyes and a square hatchway for a mouth, antennae jutting at all angles, and four foil-clad landing legs. Even its name seemed to say it was alive. The astronauts called it the LEM. The reason the LM looked so strange was simple. It had to be as lightweight as possible. The Grumman designers achieved the biggest weight savings from splitting the craft into two pieces. A boxy descent stage held the rocket used for the landing, as well as the landing gear and supplies needed for the moonwalk. It would be left behind on the moon. Perched atop the box was the angular ascent stage, which contained everything else. The crew cabin with its controls, supplies, breathing oxygen, and electronics, as well as a separate rocket for the ascent from the lunar surface back to orbit. Before long, however, the LM was hopelessly overweight, and the Grumman people were obsessed with making it lighter. In short order, the seats called for in early designs were scrapped, since the astronauts would not need them in weightlessness or the moon's 1/6 G. Then all traces of aerodynamic curves were shaved off. By 1965, with 95% of the LM's design finalized, the weight trimmers were still looking for ounces. In the end, the lander became a strange mix of strength and fragility. The skin of the descent stage was only a mylar wrapping stretched over a frame. In the ascent stage, the walls of the crew cabin were thinned down until they were nothing more than a taut aluminum balloon, in some places only 0.005 inches thick. Once, a workman accidentally dropped a screwdriver inside the cabin and it went through the floor. Now, in space, it seemed deceptively flimsy. When the cabin was pressurized, the front hatch bulged outward. That had scared John Young, who was in the command module wearing nothing but a pair of long johns. He was up there muttering, "I didn't know I was volunteering to go on this damn thing in my underwear." No wonder Jim McDivitt called his LM the tissue paper spacecraft. But it was sturdy enough, even more than enough, for the moon. For about 2 hours, Cernan was to check Snoopy's systems in preparation for the next day's dress rehearsal. But when he arrived, he found himself floating in a snowstorm of white fiberglass. It had somehow blown out of an insulation blanket on the tunnel wall and had found its way into the LM via a pressurization valve. Before he could do anything more, Cernan had to vacuum the fiberglass bits out of the air. Stafford arrived to lend a hand and burst out laughing. There was Cernan with bits of white stuck to his hair, his eyelashes, his mouth. All Stafford could think of was chicken-plucking time at the poultry house. There followed a couple of hours of concentrated work. Cernan was tunnel-visioned into his checklists, and when there was a lull, he stopped and consciously tried to take in what was happening. On his first spaceflight, the Gemini 9 mission 3 years earlier, Cernan's moment of realization had come during a 2-hour spacewalk. He was floating next to the spacecraft, with no sense of speed as he whizzed around the Earth at 17,500 miles per hour, about to make an unsuccessful attempt to test a rocket-powered backpack. And he took a moment to look around at the planet passing beneath him, at the craft that was his sanctuary in the void, at the blinding sun and the dark of space. The same thing happened now, inside Snoopy, as Cernan looked up from his checklist. The two triangular windows were still covered by translucent yellow shades, but he could see the moon's surface through them, drifting slowly and silently past, eerie because of the yellow tint. He wasn't quite sure it was real, and he said to himself, "Do you realize where you really are?" Thursday, May 22nd, 1:35 p.m., Houston time, 4 days, 2 hours, 46 minutes mission elapsed time. Charlie Brown and Snoopy flew in formation through the unfiltered lunar sunlight. For about half an hour, the two craft had drifted above the craters while the three men prepared for what lay ahead. An hour from now, Stafford and Cernan would fire Snoopy's descent engine and enter a lopsided ellipse called the descent orbit, with a low point of only 50,000 feet. On a real landing at that 9-mile altitude, the lander's engine would reignite for the final descent to the surface. But on this mission, Stafford and Cernan would simply coast along, then soar up to 215 miles, then swoop down once more. On the low passes, the pilots would reconnoiter Apollo Landing Site 2, a small patch of moonscape near the southwestern edge of the Sea of Tranquility. Then, Stafford and Cernan would cast off their descent stage and fire the ascent rocket to rejoin Young. Now, with a burst from Charlie Brown's maneuvering thrusters, Young pulled away. Inside Snoopy, Stafford and Cernan saw the command module shrink into the distance. "Have a good time while we're gone, babe," Cernan called. "Yeah," Stafford said. "Don't get lonesome out there, John," Cernan added wryly. "And don't accept any TEI updates." "Don't you worry," said Young. It was the kind of banter that often comes to fighter pilots when their necks are out. Stafford and Cernan knew only too well that they were flying a craft that could not take them back to Earth, that if something went wrong down there at 50,000 feet, Young would have to come get them. Ultimately, the lunar landing was a walk across a long high wire, and they were about to take the penultimate step. 2:35 p.m. Now came the moment of truth. It was time for Stafford and Cernan to fire Snoopy's descent engine to enter the descent orbit. It would take about half a minute to shift the low point of Snoopy's orbit from 69 miles to roughly 50,000 feet. The timing was critical, for if the burn went even 2 seconds too long, the lunar module would crash into the front side of the moon. Meanwhile, in Charlie Brown, John Young listened in and tracked Snoopy with the command module sextant ready to come to the rescue if Stafford and Cernan had a malfunction that prevented them from getting into the proper orbit. At the proper moment, Snoopy's computer flashed 99, and Cernan pushed the proceed button. The engine fired soundlessly in the vacuum. "We're burning, John," called Cernan. Inside Charlie Brown, Young could see the glow from Snoopy's engine. Half a minute later, the burn was over, and Snoopy's computer showed they were right on target. Almost immediately, Stafford and Cernan sensed their diminishing altitude. Within 20 minutes, they were dramatically lower. The moon's curved edge flattened out. As Snoopy flew onward, mountains appeared on the horizon. As Stafford and Cernan advanced, they could see that the mountains were actually the rims of huge craters. Enormous boulders dotted the land. Some looked as big as 5-story buildings. After the flight, Stafford would find out they were 10 times that size. There were cliffs that must have been 4,000 or 5,000 feet high. The mountains of the lunar highlands looked close enough to touch. Suddenly the men were stunned by the sight of their first Earth rise. Now they were in contact with Capcom Charlie Duke, and Cernan's voice soared. "Houston, this is Snoopy. We is go and we is down among 'em, Charlie." Down they flew, heading for landing site 2. Shadows lengthened as they coasted into the realm of lunar morning. Now they were over Tranquility's plains, smooth like wet clay. To Stafford, they seemed almost like the desert near Edwards. Later, he would report that Site 2 looked smoother than he expected, at least in the center of the area. but he would warn that if Armstrong and Aldrin were off target, and especially a few miles downrange, the terrain would be rougher, and they had better have enough fuel to maneuver around and look for a safe spot. Stafford and Cernan had flown routinely at 50,000 feet, but this was unlike any airplane ride. No one had ever flown this fast at such low altitude. Following the laws of orbital motion, Snoopy had traded its altitude for speed until it was now nearing 3,700 miles per hour, more than five times the speed of sound. Stafford and Cernan were barnstorming the moon. 5:33 p.m. Flying upside down and backward, Stafford and Cernan prepared to rejoin the command module by firing the lander's ascent engine. First, they would cast off Snoopy's descent stage by firing a set of pyrotechnic bolts. "That mother may give us a kick," Cernan warned. "You ready?" Suddenly, Cernan saw the moon's horizon spin wildly. The lander was tumbling out of control. Still on hot mic, his words heard by the listening Earth, Cernan blurted, "Son of a bitch, what the hell happened?" Stafford quickly punched the button to get rid of the heavy descent stage, to give him more authority with Snoopy's small maneuvering thrusters. For 8 long seconds he struggled to regain control, and then Snoopy was still. After the flight, the incident would be traced to a combination of minor and easily correctable failures. 10 minutes later, in darkness, the ascent engine started Stafford and Cernan on their journey back to John Young. 31 hours after that, early in the morning of May 24th, the second team of moon voyagers headed back to Earth. In Houston, Neil Armstrong and his crew were into their final months of preparation. When Tom Stafford's crew came back from the moon, only the landing remained. Everything else was now part of the collective spaceflight experience. Because when one team of astronauts and flight controllers learned something on a mission, it was as if all of them had done it. The achievements of one mission were there for the next to build on, and the mistakes would not be repeated. Or so everyone hoped. The way was now clear for Apollo 11 to attempt the ultimate test flight. 3. Down to the wire. He was alone, high above the flat Texas landscape, with only the sound of the air rushing past his canopy. From the ground, you might have seen him, wafting on the thermal currents, circling in wide arcs. Whenever he got the chance, Neil Armstrong took time out from the pressure of his life as an astronaut to go soaring. He loved this kind of flying, unpowered, pure, mentally demanding, as much as he did any other. In short, there wasn't anything about flying that didn't interest him. But it was here, apart from the world, harnessing the wind, that Armstrong found his greatest relaxation. Almost from the moment his name was announced as the commander of Apollo 11, the press tried to know him, and for the most part he gave them shy smiles and brief, almost cryptic answers to their questions about his thoughts and feelings. By his own admission, he much preferred to talk about ideas than people. What emerged from their typewriters became a kind of legend, the small-town Ohio boyhood, the love affair with airplanes that began earlier than he could remember, the way he devoured books as a schoolboy, how he built airplane models and tested them in a homemade wind tunnel, how he got his pilot's license before he learned to drive. They wrote of his achievements in the Korean War, where he flew 78 combat missions and was awarded a couple of air medals. They chronicled his career as a test pilot and an astronaut, but like his sailplane, Armstrong was essentially beyond their reach. There had always been that quality about him. Even in the summer of 1955, when he arrived at Edwards Air Force Base, where a small group of flyers was exploring the unknowns of high-speed flight for the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics, Edwards was a place of blast furnace heat, howling winds, and utter desolation, but it was heaven on earth for pilots. Dawn came still and clear, spilling over distant mountain ranges onto a smooth, hard expanse of clay that seemed as vast as the cloudless blue canopy above. Armstrong loved the dawn at Edwards and reveled in its short-lived serenity. Short-lived, because on any given morning the stillness was shattered by the sonic booms of pilots unleashing the most exotic flying machines in existence. Somehow, the primitive beauty of Edwards was the perfect backdrop to the unfolding of the future, and it was the perfect place for Neil Armstrong. NACA's high-speed flight station was perched on the edge of Rogers Dry Lake. The NACA flyers epitomized a new breed of test pilot, engineers as much as aviators, that had emerged since the Second World War. Unlike the Air Force pilots at Edwards, who seemed to treat a new airplane as if it were a romantic conquest, losing interest as soon as they'd used it to set a record, the NACA pilots delved into lengthy, often tedious, analyses that were the heart and soul of test flight. The combination of meticulous research and all kinds of flying opportunities, the mundane as well as the exotic, was what made Edwards a place to be cherished. Armstrong would look back on his years at Edwards as the most fascinating period of his life. There were two things about this quiet young man, whose clear, boyish face made him look even younger than his 25 years, that the other NACA pilots found remarkable. Not his flying. He was a skilled aviator with an impressive grasp of aerodynamics, but they were better stick and rudder men at Edwards. No, the first thing they noticed was his intellect. Everything he did, even casual speech, seemed to be the result of a great deal of thought. The second was his remoteness. Armstrong often kept people at arm's length. He rarely engaged in idle conversation and steadfastly guarded his privacy. He and his wife, Jan, hadn't been there very long before they left the community that clung to the base and moved into a cabin in the Juniper Hills, among the Joshua trees, without electricity or running water. Was such a man knowable? One friend would say years later that at his core, Armstrong was Scottish, with the moral code of a Highlander, rock-solid integrity, and a relentless memory of any injustice committed against him or his kin. In time, the NACA pilots realized that Armstrong wasn't aloof. He was shy. Once they got past his great reserve, they found warmth. Once he became a friend, he was a good friend. If he could be reticent, then he could also become so involved in conversation while driving that his passengers nervously eyed the road. Under the serious layers lurked a tart and understated wit. If he was a consummate loner, then it was also true that a post-flight party in full swing usually saw Armstrong at the piano, pounding out a bit of ragtime. He might be the last to leave. But even his friends could only guess at what Armstrong was thinking, what really drove him. As fellow NACA veteran Milt Thompson said years later, "I knew him, but I didn't know him." At Edwards, Armstrong saw the blue desert sky and envisioned the trackless void beyond. In the mid-50s, space travel was something most people were careful to avoid talking about in serious tones, but it wasn't far out to the people at Edwards, and Armstrong soon sensed that the road to space began on the high desert. The Air Force and NACA were sitting down to design a sleek, winged rocket plane called the X-15, a descendant of the rocket-powered X-1 that Chuck Yeager had used to break the sound barrier here a decade earlier. Carried aloft under the wing of a B-52 bomber and then released, the X-15 would zoom to the fringe of the atmosphere, then glide to an unpowered or dead stick landing on the lake bed. Armstrong was among the handful of pilots slated to fly it. In the meantime, there was Sputnik, which set off a chain of events that moved space flight toward reality faster than Armstrong could have anticipated. By 1959, NACA had become the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and Project Mercury was in the headlines. Some, though not all, of the Edwards men snickered at the idea of astronauts, who would be essentially passengers from start to finish. The NASA pilots knew that they, not the Mercury astronauts, were on the cutting edge, and that they would fly into space at the controls of the X-15's more advanced successor. Soon that craft, too, was on the drawing board. Dyna Soar, a manned glider designed to be lofted by a Titan booster and then land on a runway. Armstrong was named NASA's prime pilot on Dyna Soar. He had no interest in becoming a Mercury astronaut. By 1962, in its third year of operations, the X-15 was streaking through the desert sky at unheard-of velocities, more than five times the speed of sound, and record altitudes. That April, on his sixth X-15 flight, Armstrong piloted the sleek black Arrow to 207,000 feet, high enough to see a bright and gently curving horizon beneath a black sky. For a moment, he lingered there at the top of his arc, suspended between aviation and spaceflight, before returning to Earth. The view from 207,000 feet only whetted Armstrong's appetite. He felt he had glimpsed his own future. But that future, he realized, was not in the X-15 or in Dinosaur, which now seemed doomed never to leave the drawing board. Already, John Glenn had demonstrated that astronauts were more than passengers by taking over manual control of his Mercury spacecraft when the automatic system malfunctioned. Armstrong realized he'd been hasty in rejecting the astronaut program. It wasn't easy to think about leaving Edwards, but NASA was headed for the moon. The week he flew the X-15 to the heights, NASA put out the call for the second group of astronauts. One day, Armstrong and a fellow NASA pilot named Bill Dana were mulling over their respective plans. Dana said he thought there was a much better future flying the supersonic transport that everyone was talking about. Armstrong told him, "You can do whatever you want to about that, but space is the frontier, and that's where I intend to go." June 1969, Flight Crew Training Building, Kennedy Space Center. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin stood side by side in the lunar module simulator. A soft green light filled the enclosure, emanating from dozens of electroluminescent dials and readouts. "Okay, Neil," said a voice in their headsets. "We'll give it to you at pitch over minus 30 seconds. It was the voice of one of the simulation instructors who sat at a console nearby. On the instrument panel, gauges jumped to life and registered engine temperature, chamber pressure, fuel and oxidizer readings, thrust, and the other vital signs of a lunar module in flight. A tape meter scrolled down ever-diminishing readings of altitude. Another showed their speed of descent. Two eight-ball indicators showed the LM's orientation in space. Armstrong and Aldrin scanned each gauge, just as they would in the moments before the lander began its final descent to the surface. Suddenly, a coded message flashed on the LM's computer display. P-64, Aldrin announced, and suddenly, through the two small triangular windows, a bright moonscape swung upward into view. Once again, as they had done many times over the past few months, Armstrong and Aldrin were about to confront Apollo's greatest unknown. "Space is the frontier," Neil Armstrong had said 7 years earlier, and with the lunar landing he had found a piloting task at the frontier of space flight. Nothing like it had ever been attempted. The liftoff from the moon, on which his and Aldrin's lives would depend, would be a rocket launch that was basically like many others, only the launch site would be extraordinary. But a manned rocket landing, that was something for which there was no prior experience. The airless moon offered no alternatives. The trip from 50,000 feet down to the surface would be, in essence, a long, controlled fall from orbit, a trajectory governed by the same exacting laws of motion as orbit itself, called the powered descent. It would begin with the LM flying horizontally over the moon at a speed of just under 3,800 miles per hour, and would end with a touchdown as gentle as a leap from a bar stool. There were two keys to the powered descent. One was an engineering marvel, the world's first rocket engine with a throttle. With it, the LM could descend at a whole range of speeds. If necessary, it could even hover in the sky like a helicopter. The second was the LM's onboard computer. More than half the lander's weight was fuel for the descent rocket, but the fuel budget was so tight that there would have been little chance of making it to the surface without computer control. The computer wizards at MIT had programmed it to govern the entire descent. It would compute the precise amount of thrust needed from the descent engine at any given moment. It would keep track of the LM's distance to the designated landing site. It would share control of the spacecraft with the pilot, or, if asked, give up control altogether. In their simulations of the powered descent, Armstrong and Aldrin began where Tom Stafford and Gene Cernan left off. 9 miles above the moon. With the lander tipped back horizontal, they lit the descent engine and throttled up to full power, using its thrust to break their orbital speed. Obeying Kepler's laws, the lander fell moonward as it slowed. In this early phase, the craft was oriented with its windows facing the moon. This allowed Armstrong to observe landmarks passing underneath and use them to judge whether he and Aldrin were on the proper trajectory. Then, some 4.5 minutes into the descent, the craft rotated until it was windows up, allowing the LM's landing radar to bounce echoes off the surface to determine altitude. At about 6 minutes, the computer throttled the engine down to 55% thrust, and the long break continued. Throughout this period, if everything went well, Armstrong and Aldrin did little more than watch the gauges. Finally, 8.5 minutes after engine ignition, the final phase of the powered descent began. Some 7,500 feet above the moon, the computer pitched the lander forward until it was nearly upright. This was called the pitchover maneuver, so that its engine would not only break the craft's forward speed, but keep it from falling too fast. From then on, the lander followed a slanting path to the surface, like a car braking on a long, straight mountain road, with the computer carefully riding the throttle like a motorist's foot on the brake. With only 4 minutes from pitchover to touchdown, things happened very fast. In that sense, landing on the moon was similar to Armstrong's X-15 flights. Some X-15 pilots talked of a kind of fast time when the clock seemed to race. There wasn't time to read checklists. They had to have the entire flight plan memorized. Pilots sometimes talk about being ahead of the airplane, a state of mind that enables you to think one step ahead of your craft, the better to cope with emergencies. But that was nearly impossible flying a rocket plane at 5 times the speed of sound, and it wouldn't be much easier in a lunar module descending to the moon. For Armstrong, pitchover was the moment when the piloting part of the landing began. With the cratered plains of the Sea of Tranquility spread before him, he scanned the advancing moonscape, looking for familiar landmarks he had memorized from photos, and by using a special grid called the Landing Point Designator, he could see for the first time where the computer was aiming to land. The LPD grid was marked off in degrees on the LM's double-pane window and was used like a gun sight. By sighting along the grid at the proper angle, which was supplied by the computer, Armstrong was able to spot the landing point. If he didn't like what he saw, he could tell the computer to change its aim by nudging the LM's attitude controller with his right hand. A nudge to the left or right shifted the aim point accordingly. Tilting the controller backward or forward moved the landing spot up or downrange. Meanwhile, Aldrin interrogated the computer, asking it for the LM's height and speed and comparing the results with the data from the radar. Then he relayed this information to Armstrong. Aldrin knew very well that his title of Lunar Module Pilot was a misnomer, because all the flying during the landing, and there might not be much of it, belonged to Armstrong. In theory, Armstrong knew, he could let the computer fly the LM all the way to touchdown without touching the controls. In reality, he wasn't about to do that. It wasn't just that, as a self-respecting test pilot, he wanted to be at the controls at the moment of landing. It was because the computer was blind. It might bring him and Aldrin down on an absolutely perfect trajectory, right into a crater or a boulder field. Armstrong planned to take over from the computer when he was about 500 feet above the moon. Even then, Armstrong would let the computer do most of the work. Flying the LM entirely by hand was so difficult that he wanted to avoid it at all costs, and unless the computer went out, he wouldn't have to. Instead, he would maneuver the LM by tilting it slightly to one side and let the computer continue to ride the throttle. Armstrong knew there was always the possibility that something would go wrong, from communications failure to a malfunction of the descent rocket, and force him to abort the landing. In that case, he could press the button marked Abort Stage, setting off a dramatic chain of events. In an instant, pyrotechnic bolts would sever the connections between the descent and ascent stages. At the same moment, the ascent rocket would blast to life, boosting Armstrong and Aldrin back toward orbit. But an abort, especially one at low altitude, carried its own risks. If the ascent engine didn't light, there would be no time to find out why and do something about it. Armstrong and Aldrin would crash in a matter of seconds. Even if it did fire, the ascent stage might not separate cleanly from the descent stage. And even if there were no malfunctions, there was the problem of finding Collins, with the timing for the rendezvous now completely disrupted. Armstrong and Aldrin would face a long and complicated journey back to the command module, and it would have been several hours since Aldrin had aligned the LM's guidance system with the stars. An abort would force the men to fly with a guidance system that could be significantly in error. And so the last thing Armstrong wanted to do was abort, not only because it would mean failure, but because it could be even more risky than the landing itself. As the LM got very close to the moon, Armstrong and Aldrin would enter the most hazardous portion of the descent. Somewhere in the last 200 feet, they would be too low to abort successfully if the descent engine quit, for the LM would be going too fast for the ascent engine to arrest the lander's plunge and start the ascent stage upward again. The astronauts, borrowing a term from helicopter pilots, called this part of the descent the dead man's curve. Even if nothing went wrong, Armstrong would have his hands full. Already, he would have had to find a safe landing spot, free of large craters and boulders. By the time the LM was 100 feet up, Armstrong would have had to arrest nearly all of the craft's forward motion and begin a slow, careful, vertical descent. The computer would still control the throttle, but Armstrong would be able to make small adjustments by using a special toggle switch. By clicking the switch up or down, he could increase or decrease his rate of descent by 1 foot per second, repeating this as many times as necessary to get the change he wanted. It seemed to Armstrong to be a strange way to control a craft, and he was skeptical that the switch would prove effective in the actual landing. But he would have to wait and see until he was 100 feet above the moon. In these final moments, Armstrong's gaze would be directed almost entirely at the moon, and he would rely on Aldrin's steady reports on altitude, horizontal speed, and descent rate. The first part of the LM to touch the moon would be three long metal probes attached to the footpads. At that moment, a blue light labeled Lunar Contact would glow on the instrument panel. Aldrin would be watching for the contact light, ready to call it out. At that moment, Armstrong would shut down the engine, and the LM would fall the remaining 3 feet to the surface. Perhaps the toughest thing about landing on the moon was that there was no such thing as a second chance. Even in carrier landings, and Armstrong had flown plenty of those in Korea, there was usually the chance to circle and try again if something went wrong the first time. But in the lunar landing, he and Aldrin would have to stay on top of any problems that might come up, even as the computer brought them closer to the moon. No surprise that the simulator instructors knew Armstrong and Aldrin as serious students. Aldrin, who was becoming a virtuoso with the LM's computer, was a bundle of self-confidence, ready to debate with instructors and experts on any technical matter. Armstrong was all business, as the man whom Mike Collins would call far and away the most experienced test pilot among the astronauts. Armstrong had seen his share of close calls, and more than once had faced malfunctions he had never seen in simulations, including one on his Gemini 8 mission that nearly cost him his life. It was March 5, 1966, and Armstrong had just accomplished the first space docking, linking up with an Agena target rocket 185 miles above the Earth. He and his co-pilot, Dave Scott, were monitoring the instruments on the joined spacecraft when suddenly they began to tumble. The men were sure that the problem was a stuck thruster on the Agena. If they let it continue, Armstrong knew, the tumbling might break the two craft apart. He undocked, and the Gemini began to gyrate faster and faster, spinning a full turn every second as the Earth and Sun alternately flashed by the windows. Armstrong's vision blurred as he searched the instrument panel, and he said to Scott, in a voice tinged with wryness, "I gotta cage my eyeballs." Armstrong brought all his energy to bear on the problem, trying methodically to isolate the stuck thruster, but he could not. If the spin worsened, he and Scott were in danger of losing consciousness. Then it would be only a matter of time before the Gemini broke apart. Armstrong was forced to turn off the main thrusters and switch on a backup system reserved only for re-entry, an action which was tantamount to aborting the flight. Half a minute later, he had halted the spin and lost the mission. Other than disappointment, Armstrong carried no special psychic burden from that incident. He had no score to settle. He had been in the test flight business too long not to view Gemini 8 as just another page in the history of his profession, another encounter with the unexpected. Now, training to land on the moon, it was the unknowns that Armstrong worried about most. For the first few weeks of training, the instructors went easy on Armstrong and Aldrin. In one practice landing after another, the two pilots worked out the teamwork they would need to handle the descent. By the time Stafford's crew came back from the moon, Armstrong and Aldrin were landing confidently and smoothly. And then, the instructors decided, the honeymoon was over, and they were nothing short of diabolical in their efforts to push their students to the limit. Now there was a Gemini 8 every day, and Armstrong was unflappable. The instructors would freeze the pointing mechanism for the descent rocket so that the nozzle could no longer be aimed from side to side, and Armstrong would compensate by tilting the entire lunar module when he wanted to change direction. They would make a maneuvering rocket stick in the on position when he was in his final hovering descent, and Armstrong would cant the LM against the unwanted thrust as if he were leaning an airplane into a crosswind. Every so often, in their efforts to reach new levels of ruthlessness, the instructors threw in a set of emergencies so complex, so difficult, that no one could have handled them. With other astronauts, this usually brought words of protest from the cockpit. "What the hell are you giving me that for? That's negative training." But no matter what they did to Armstrong, the instructors never heard an angry word from the simulator. Instead, they'd find out only in the discussion afterward, sitting around the console, when Armstrong's clear, pale face would turn red, and his usually restrained voice would crack, and the instructors would know they had pushed the war too far this time. Minutes later, Armstrong would be back at the controls, taking another try, and he never ended a session without making it down successfully. By the end of May, the simulator at the Cape was linked via radio to the Mission Control Center in Houston. These so-called integrated simulations were designed to test not only the astronauts, but the flight controllers. Integrated simulations were considered essential, and for good reason. Spaceflight is not a solo venture by daring pilots. It is a partnership between the astronauts and Mission Control, and nothing demonstrated this more than landing on the moon. For the dozens of flight controllers who worked for Chris Kraft, the first lunar landing was a coveted goal, just as it was for the astronauts. The flight director who would be in charge during the landing was Eugene F. Kranz, a former Air Force fighter pilot who had flown F-86s in Korea. With rugged features and a light blonde crew cut, Kranz had the look of a drill sergeant. During Gemini, one of his flight controllers nicknamed him General Savage. Inside, Kranz was as sentimental as they come. Like most people at NASA, he was an unabashed patriot who could get misty when he heard the Star-Spangled Banner. At the start of the workday, he would go into his office and listen to John Philip Sousa marches to get his blood flowing. He was a devout Catholic and a man of strong beliefs, and at his core, he believed in the exploration of space. The space program wasn't just a part of his life, it was his life. At age 35, Kranz was already a veteran flight director. He had begun his tour in Mission Control in 1960 as Chris Kraft's assistant flight director during Mercury, then as a flight director himself in Gemini, then he had moved on to Apollo. He'd been in the flight director's chair for more emergencies than he cared to think about, including Armstrong and Scott's brush with disaster in Gemini 8. Every nerve was tuned to the process of making decisions under pressure. During the landing, Kranz would sit in the third row of the Mission Operations Control Room, presiding over a team of flight controllers who would keep track of every system on board the descending lunar module and monitor its trajectory down to the moon. Each controller would in turn rely on his own team of backroom experts down the hall from the MOCR. Kranz knew his team of flight controllers the way a battle commander knows his troops. These young men, like all the people who worked for Chris Kraft, were exceedingly bright. It was extraordinary what these people could do, together, during a mission. Kranz had seen it happen time and again. In the compressed moments of a launch or some other critical phase, they became one giant conglomerate brain, 20 minds wired together in parallel, each focused on some small piece of the whole event. In such situations, they could solve almost any problem that came their way, given 20 seconds to work on it. In 20 seconds, a controller could look at the problem, talk to someone in his back room, think, talk to someone else, come back to the first person, and make a decision. And all the while, he would be monitoring the events around him, listening not only to the conversations on the flight director's loop, but the air-to-ground and perhaps one or two other loops. The amount of information processed by one controller was staggering, and the entire team was trained for that kind of split-computer mentality. With that kind of brain power at work, 20 seconds could be a long time. Kranz and his team started simulating lunar landings as soon as Apollo 10 ended. At first, they worked on their own, using computers to take the place of simulators and instructors instead of astronauts. After that, they moved on to the integrated simulations. Sometimes Armstrong and Aldrin were in the simulator at the Cape. At other times, it might be the backup crew or the Apollo 12 team. In any case, the simulations were so realistic that it was impossible to tell the difference from a real flight. People who sat in on them experienced gut-wrenching tension. The simulation instructors in Houston waged war on Kranz and his team relentlessly, as their counterparts at the Cape did with Armstrong and Aldrin. Their goal was to find the open seams in their decision-making, to trap them right at the instant when two options overlapped, so that if they made the wrong choice, or picked the right one but didn't implement it in time, there would be no recovery. Kranz was the point man. If an emergency came up, he would have to decide whether to continue or order an abort, and that was where things went bad in late May. It was difficult for the controllers to master the complexity of the powered descent. It was especially tough for them to judge when the astronauts had entered the dead man's curve. Then there was the added wrinkle of the lunar distance. It took 1.3 seconds for a message from the spacecraft to reach Earth, and another 1.3 seconds for Mission Control's reply to reach the astronauts. That delay was also part of the simulations, but the most difficult part was getting the feel of how to handle malfunctions during the powered descent. At first, the controllers were so conservative, they'd abort at the first sign of trouble. Afterward, the simulation instructors would point out to Kranz's men that they could have kept going if only they had done such and such, and the next time the team would be so daring that the problems would overtake them and the LM would crash into the moon. By the first part of June, there had been so many crashes that Kranz wondered if he and his team would ever get it right. Kranz wasn't alone. During integrated simulations, every manager in Houston, Chris Kraft included, was listening to the squawk box in his office as if it were the best radio show on the air. After the first crash, the black telephone behind the flight director's console rang, and it was Kraft. Despite his concern, he almost joked about it. "I see you let it get away from you." The next time the black phone rang, perhaps a week later, Kraft wasn't joking anymore. "What's the matter with you guys?" Kranz wasn't sure he knew. Maybe the answer was that no one had ever tried anything like this before. Kranz had the distinct impression that the astronauts were getting frustrated, too. It was hard enough just getting the complex simulator at the Cape, not to mention the roomfuls of computers in Houston, to work long enough to get in all the